Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Welcome to the inaugural podcast in the Law and Social Innovation podcast series, an initiative of the Eugene and Carol Ludwig Center for Community and Economic Development at Yale Law School. This podcast series explores the intersection of creative community development and inspired and inspiring social change. One of America's largest agribusiness companies is learning what can grow out of community-minded litigation. Monsanto, which has made a habit of threatening independent farmers whose land has been contaminated by the company's genetically modified seeds, has been sued by a coalition of over 80 farmers, seed sellers, and local organizations. Yale Law students from the school's Community Economic Development Clinic, Jen Shu and Johnny Dock, sat down with Dan Ravager, president of the Public Patent Foundation and lead counsel in the suit, and Bill Dusing, director of the Northeast Organic Farming Association of Connecticut, to discuss this litigation.
So, Dan, you're the lead lawyer in a case defending small farmers against Monsanto. Can you give us some background on the case and what it's about, what you hope to achieve?
Sure, happy to, and thanks again for having me here today. Our case is not about money. It's not even about asking Monsanto to stop doing anything. All we seek in our case is to protect our clients from any threat that they could be sued for patent infringement in the future. So the question is, how on earth could our clients be sued for patent infringement? Well, Monsanto has patents on their genetically modified seed that they aggressively assert. They filed over 140 lawsuits against farmers for infringing their patents on their genetically modified seed, and they license to thousands more that we don't even know about. If you go to buy a bag of their seed, you have to sign a very onerous license agreement, and on the bag itself, above the health warnings, is a box that says, stop, these seeds are protected by patents. Well, none of our clients want to use Monsanto's seed. They're all either organic, some are even biodynamic, and some, while not being organic or biodynamic, nonetheless reject the use of genetically modified seed. But they unfortunately live in communities and environments where they could be contaminated by a neighbor or some other source of genetically modified seed. And although you would think if you're contaminated by someone else's genetically modified seed, that you might actually be able to sue them for whatever injury that contamination caused you, the law is actually the opposite. The law actually allows the owner of patents on that seed to sue you because now you are making and using, quote unquote, their seed, even if you don't know about it. So Monsanto has actually accused people of patent infringement who were outspokenly against the use of genetically modified seed. They've harassed these people, they've threatened them, and they've chilled their conduct. So we represent a group of 3 dozen family farmers, a dozen organic or non-GMO seed sellers, and about 3 dozen agricultural organizations, all of whom are worried that they may become contaminated by genetically modified seed and thus subject to a threat by Monsanto for patent infringement. So we went to court first, preemptively, which we're allowed to do, simply to ask the court to award our clients a declaratory judgment that if they ever were to become contaminated by Monsanto seed, they could never be sued for patent infringement.
There's an impressive number and variety of plaintiffs named in the case. Can you talk about what it's been like to work with so many different stakeholders?
Well, we do have clients all the way from Maine to California, Washington to Florida, everywhere in between. We represent, if you include the members of the agricultural organizations who are represented, we represent tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people across the country. And what that says is this is an issue that's nationwide. It impacts everyone. We represent cotton farmers in Texas, canola, people who want to grow canola in North Dakota, people who simply want to grow soybeans or corn. It really crosses not just geographically, but also many different agricultural segments. And that shows how pervasive this problem is. Monsanto has in many of these markets 85-90% of the market share. They are a monopolist. And they simply want to destroy the remaining portion of the market so that they can be the sole supplier of all seed in the country. And they want all the seed to be their patented genetically modified seed.
Bill, you're the executive director of an organization that's named as a plaintiff to the suit. Can you talk about what your experience has been as Connecticut NOFA, working with Dan?
Yes, I'm Executive Director of Connecticut NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association here in Connecticut. We're one of seven state chapters in the Northeast. When we first heard about this, we hadn't been approached or hadn't had an opportunity to sign on, but we noticed several of our sister chapters had, and that seemed very good, but we felt a little left out. And then there was a legal thing that Monsanto did, I guess, which led an opening for to add more plaintiffs to that thing. And at that point, I think all the NOFA chapters joined, and there were a bunch of other farmers and people who joined. It's been good for us to do it. It feels really good to try to stop this imposition that Monsanto's made. I spent a bunch of time with Percy Smizer, who's a canola grower in Canada, whose lifetime seed breeding was contaminated by Monsanto's genetically modified canola seeds genes, and then he was taken all the way to the Canadian Supreme Court and made some progress, but it wasn't, didn't pay him back for destroying his life's seed work.
NOFA and the other plaintiffs have issues in common beyond Monsanto and genetically modified seed. I know that they've been provided with a detailed document with contact information and other details about all of the plaintiffs in the suit. Dan, do you see this litigation as laying the groundwork for other community organizing and advocacy efforts in the field, or Bill, has NOFA found the lawsuit encourages communication either among its members or between NOFA and other groups?
Well, I think this case is a good example of how many different people from across the country can work together to achieve a common interest. As I said earlier, some of the plaintiffs are biodynamic, which is what I like to call organic squared. And then other people don't even want to adopt organic standards. So we have a very diverse group of people who actually, if you sat them in the room, wouldn't agree on a lot of things. But on this issue, whether or not they should be sued for patent infringement, they become contaminated, they do all agree that they should not be allowed to be subject to such a threat. So I, as the lawyer for this case, really only care about this case. But if there are some positive externalities that come from it, which show that people can work together and build relationships on common ground to fight a common threat, then I think that would also be a good result.
Bill, have you seen any of those externalities?
Yes, it's helped us as a chapter work together, and especially have identified among the other challenges we face, the GMO issue among our state chapters. This is one aspect of it. One of the things that happened when the USDA took over organic certification is they encouraged very greatly organic seeds. So it ramped up the production of organic seeds in this country, which is very important to have seeds that are bred under organic conditions rather than under chemical conditions. And so, but this is the Monsanto's genes, which go out and pollute the environment, would be an impediment for that.
Bill mentioned earlier that something had happened. Well, he mentioned a couple things I just wanted to clarify for people in case they're curious. So one of the issues is when you bring litigation, there are some professional responsibility limitations on your ability to recruit people. You know, we all know the stereotypical ambulance chasing, which you don't want to do as a lawyer. And so many of the clients came to us through referrals or other contacts they had in the community. We're not the type of lawyers who actually firmly go out to aggressively recruit lawyers to trump up litigation. You know, when I first started investigating this case, I wanted to make sure that it was legitimately worth my time. There's plenty of other cases I could be doing with my time. There's plenty of other ways in which the patent system's harming the public, or the public needs protection from undeserved patents or overly aggressively asserted patents. But the more people I spoke to, the more I was convinced that this was important. So that's why at first we had not been in touch with Bill's organization. Then what happened was, after we filed the lawsuit, you might know as a lawyer, but many of your non-lawyers may not know, that you have to actually serve the lawsuit on the other party before it technically gets started. And there's been movies about this with process servers trying to have. So we're allowed some period of time to serve the complaint. Well, before we wanted to actually start this lawsuit and cause a lot of people to spend time and money, we actually just wrote Monsanto a very simple letter. I think it was maybe 2 pages long, saying, hey, we filed this lawsuit in New York. We haven't yet served it on you. If you would just give us a promise that you would never sue us for patent infringement, you now know who we are. You now know that we're all opposed to your seed. We would never want to steal it or use it behind your back without paying. None of us want to use your seed. Just write us a simple one sentence piece of paper that says you'll never sue us if we happen to get contaminated for patent infringement. Instead of simply responding to that by saying, of course, we would never sue you, Monsanto went out and hired the former Solicitor General of the United States, Seth Waxman, and several lawyers at a very high-powered D.C. law firm, WilmerHale, to represent us in this case and filed dozens of pages of legal paperwork to say that we don't deserve to bring this case because there's not an actual controversy. And it just seems ridiculous because we just said, tell us there's not a controversy by writing one sentence that says, we will not sue you for patent infringement if you become contaminated. And so when Monsanto did that, which actually shocked me that they did that, they lawyered up instead of just addressing our plain and simple question. That's when we had the right to amend our complaint, which we did by including this correspondence we had with Monsanto to prove to the judge that this wasn't some, you know, fabricated issue. This was a real controversy. We asked them to clarify our risk. They refused to do that. That's further support of how real this is and what their intentions may be in the future. So when we refiled, we also at that time were permitted to add additional plaintiffs. And during that time, we became came in contact with Bill and several other plaintiffs, which we added. We originally filed with, I believe, 60, and then when we refiled, we had 83. So just to resolve those two issues for the listeners.
Some of those 83 on the amended complaint are international organizations in Canada and India, at least that I know about. Can you talk about the international implications of the suit, the effects it might have on other countries or on community and economic development in those countries?
Right. So there's both direct and indirect international impacts. First of all, if you're an international grower but you want to sell your products into U.S. markets, you're still subject to personal jurisdiction here in the United States, and you could be sued for patent infringement if you're suing allegedly infringing products here. So that's where many of our Canadian entities are concerned. Even though they couldn't be sued for making or using it, they could be sued for selling or importing an allegedly infringing seed or resulting product in the United States. And that's the basis for their jurisdiction in the case and why it's relevant, because of the importance of interaction with U.S. markets. But indirectly, we hope that people will see that this is a case which is bringing to light the issues underlying these patents, and I hope we get a moment to talk about them, because one of them is really, I think, critical, which is the social utility requirement of patent law, and that we challenge genetically modified seed has any social utility despite Monsanto's false promises. And we hope that airing those issues and getting a fair day in court on those issues, instead of letting Monsanto continue to hide the ball and prevent true scientific challenge to their purported technology, well, we believe have ramifications throughout the world. Many parts of the world already reject or at least skeptical about their claims, and rightly so.
Can you talk about reasons that the rest of the world might have gone further in avoiding GM food than the United States?
Well, I can't know for sure, because I'm not inside the minds of these people and they haven't consulted with me. But, you know, we do have a problem of a revolving door between industry and government here in the United States. And when the leadership of the governmental bodies, which are supposed to regulate food and agriculture, come from Monsanto and then go back to Monsanto, it's hard to believe that we're getting a publicly driven and publicly minded policy from those regulators.
And I was going to say, one of the things that made us so anxious to be involved in this was the ramping up of genetically modified varieties this year, with the approval of alfalfa and sugar beets and sweet corn. You know, the large-scale corn and soybeans don't too much affect our organic growers in Connecticut, but sweet corn and alfalfa and sugar beets, you know, get much more serious and much more involved with food crops that we would grow.
If you don't mind talking a little bit more about the patent infringement and what you're thinking in terms of bringing the case to court. You mentioned the social utility and the usefulness of the patent as one particular example. Can you expand on the other?
Sure. So we can't just go to court and ask the judge to rule that our clients should never be sued for patent infringement if contaminated. We have to actually give the judge a reason why that's the correct outcome, that if they were contaminated and sued in the future, why Monsanto would lose any such suit. So there's a couple different categories of arguments. The first category is that Monsanto's patents are just purely invalid. And there are many requirements under the patent law. One of them is this social utility requirement. And there's a very old case, I believe it's 170 years old now, which expressly says an invention to poison the people is not patentable. That's a pretty good quote, okay? And although this doctrine hasn't been used often in patent law, it nonetheless is alive and we believe will be used successfully in this case. Beyond that, there are other more technical issues about whether or not they actually invented something here. What they did is they merely combined a promoter sequence with a certain genetic trait that they wanted to turn on, which had been well known and was obvious to those of skill in the art at the time. Underlying this is a more meta patent law issue, which is we have a problem at the patent office that is just a rubber stamp for industry and will give industry as many patents as they want for as many things because they don't really care about quality at the patent office. They only care about serving, quote unquote, their customers, who are the people that pay their fees, but I'm not going to go into that tangent right now. So there's an underlying quality problem with the patents just on patent law itself. Then the next category is, even if the patents are valid, which we know they aren't, they're not infringed. And we believe there is an intent requirement in the patent law. It cannot be strict liability that someone who unintentionally becomes contaminated could then be held to have made, used, or sold the thing. Because they had no knowledge of that, they had no intent. So there's no infringement. That's the second category. The third category is called unenforceability, which many people confuse with invalidity. But the difference is unenforceability means there are equitable reasons or fairness-based reasons for refusing to enforce the patents, even if they are valid. So here, one very prominent equitable doctrine is known as misuse, which says even if you have valid patents, if you use them in a way to achieve anti-competitive benefit, the courts will refuse to enforce those patents because you've used them in a harmful way that impacts the market negatively. Well, in this situation, we have an undeniable monopolist using their patents to sue small family farmers, put them out of business, render them bankrupt. They've gone around acquiring every seed company they can that can be bought so that they can own the entire source of our food supply. And the patents are critical to that campaign. So we believe they've misused their patents, which is a basis for the judge to rule them unenforceable. And then fourth and finally, we go to the category of remedies, which in law school you learn is actually sometimes more important than the substantive issues, because it doesn't really matter if you've broken the law if the penalty is only $1, right? It doesn't really matter. So in this case, when you infringe someone's patent, even if the patents are valid, infringed, and enforceable, the judge would have to say, well, then Monsanto's entitled to some financial damages for past infringement and an injunction barring future infringement. Well, before the judge can grant damages, she has to find that there's been economic harm to Monsanto. And in this case, it's the exact opposite. Which party's harmed when Monsanto seed contaminates an organic farmer? The organic farmer, not Monsanto. They haven't lost a sale of their seed to someone. This isn't a competitor they're dealing with. So no economic damages are due. And then on the injunction issue, a judge has to consider the public interest and also the economic hardships to the parties. And again, there's no economic hardship here to Monsanto when their seed contaminates an organic farmer. And the public interest here is not supported by allowing Monsanto to shut down alternative forms of agriculture. In fact, the public interest would be opposed to that. So even if the patents are valid, infringed, and enforceable, which they aren't, Monsanto would still not be entitled to any remedy at the end of the day. So those are the four legal arguments underlying our basis to go to court and ask a judge to say that our clients could never be sued for patent infringement.
And there's another whole area which this doesn't get at, which is, as you mentioned, the farmer, organic farmer who's contaminated. We're trying to keep that farmer from being sued by Monsanto in this case, but that farmer loses a lot of value if he can't sell that crop or she can't sell that crop. And right now, I guess the Department of Agriculture, they're trying to figure out that balance. And I hear the Secretary of Agriculture is thinking that the organic farmers ought to buy crop insurance to protect them from that, rather than either the farmer who's growing it or the patent holder being responsible for that contamination. So this is just the beginning of a lot of issues that come around this.
Yeah, it's clear that the government regulators acknowledge they cannot push an anti-organic or a pro-GMO agenda because that will be transparently false and politically unsustainable. So what they've chosen to do is purport to have an unbiased, we can all get along together and we can cohabitate. You can have GMOs on one side of the road and organic on the other side of the road, and we can all get along and we'll compete. And this is the new mantra, and it seems to ring on its surface some true American values of, you know, I have the freedom to do what I want on my property, and you know, but it also sounds a lot to me, and this whole case from the beginning sounded a lot like tobacco and smoking. You know, back in the days, it was, well, why should you have the right to stop me from smoking? Me smoking doesn't hurt you, you know, even though we're in the same plane or in the same apartment building or in the same school or restaurant. And they, you know, that used to ring true, but then people learned after time there were these harmful impacts. So let's just look at what happened with canola. Okay, genetically modified canola comes along, and within a few years, organic canola is extinct. You basically can't find it anymore. Our plaintiffs who would like to grow canola can't, because they can't find any organic seed that they can rely on. Some of our seed sellers wish they could sell organic canola seed. They used to sell a heck of a lot of it and make a lot of money out of it, but now they can't because the whole supply was contaminated by genetically modified canola seed. So if we look at history, we know that having both genetically modified seed and organic seed maintained is not possible, because a genetic modified seed will just contaminate, pollute, and eventually destroy the organic alternative.
Can you explain how the contamination occurs? And you hit on it a little bit, but expand on what actually happens. Can you describe what happens? Do the seeds blow from property to property?
There's lots of ways, and Bill might know better than I, but there's lots of ways that this contamination can occur. First, it can blow over. Birds can carry it. Windstorm. Contamination when you go. There's common parts. You know, I'm not an agricultural industry expert, but there are processing facilities that are used by multiple farmers instead of them all having their own processing facilities. So you get a lot of commingling and contamination risk there. Simply, transportation causes risks, and your own seed supply. You might be getting your seed supply from someone who believes it's organic, has been told it's organic, but they might not even know that it's contaminated. So sometimes you don't know until it's too high, because the cost of testing is very expensive. And so it's very difficult for people to test. It's not possible to test every single seed you buy to make sure it's not contaminated, because you destroy the seed in testing it, right? So you have to test batches, and so it's a very difficult problem. We think the party responsible for that is Monsanto. This case isn't about that, and maybe there will be some case about that in the future, holding Monsanto liable for the negative impact of its products. But this contamination can occur in many ways, and so, yes, blowing over is an example.
Especially in corn, the pollen travels half a mile or maybe even more. So that carries the genetic material to the organic or non-GMO corn. Percy Schmeiser believes that it happened with him. He's in an area of Canada with 1,000-acre farms growing canola, and the Roundup Ready canola truck went by his place, and the stuff blew off on a windy northern Canadian plains. And then, you know, somebody sprayed the side of the road with Roundup, and those plants didn't die. So they condemned his whole crop.
Bill, we've talked about the organic farmers and about Monsanto. There's a third group here, and those are the conventional farmers. What's your experience been on the ground here in Connecticut about how sympathetic the conventional farmers growing the Roundup Ready seeds are to the plight of their neighbors, the organic farmers?
That's interesting. I was at a meeting with the fellow from Washington, actually the same deputy undersecretary at the USDA, is overseeing the organic program and the APHIS, which oversees the GMOs. So he's got both of them there. And so I mentioned something about this contamination issue and thinking that the responsibility ought to be with the patent holder. And at the end of that meeting, several of the larger dairy farmers from Connecticut came up to me, and they were confused, and they didn't seem to know very much about it. They knew they grew GMO crops, Roundup Ready corn, but they didn't have any idea about how the pollen traveled and what the contamination meant for organic and how the organic contamination would be discovered. So I think there's not a lot of thought about it. You know, it's just put out there as, you know, what you ought to do, a good product by the extension and the seed sellers and especially the people who want to sell more Roundup.
We have a good example with rice, which wasn't even released in genetically modified form for the market. It was just being tested, and it escaped and caused so much contamination. I believe the initial estimations were near $1 billion, and I believe the case settled recently in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And this was just a product that wasn't even in the marketplace yet. They didn't have 85-90% of the market like Monsanto does with these other crops. They were just testing it, and that's how much damage it caused. So the damage here is real, And what's going to happen is these conventional farmers are going to get squeezed in the middle. And I really feel for them because I believe many of them believed Monsanto's lies, that if you use their product, it'll increase yield and your work will be easier and the world will be a better place and you'll be doing the right thing by feeding the world and, you know, saving yourself some effort, all of which was just salesman nonsense, okay? Now, when the reality sets in, which is starting to set in now because these farmers are learning that after a few years, you have to use more and more and more herbicide, and that you get these super weeds now that are resistant even when you use it, and it's becoming more of a pain than it was at first. You take that on top of it doesn't increase yields at all. The evidence is clear that it does not increase yields whatsoever. Doesn't make a better product. If you did a blind taste testing, I think most people would actually be able to tell the difference between organic and genetically modified food and prefer the organic kind. And then when they are responsible, as under current property law, they will be responsible when they contaminate their neighbor. And there's already been successful suits by organic farmers who've been contaminated by their neighbors suing them. And so then who are they going to turn around? Now, in their agreements with Monsanto, Monsanto says, oh, well, we're not responsible. You have to be good stewards of our property when you use it. But eventually, even if they're not legally responsible, Monsanto hopefully will be held accountable by its customers, who we hope will start to reject them in droves. And I'm actually quite happy when I was traveling around meeting with people throughout the beginning stage of this case, is I met with several conventional farmers who didn't want to be villainized, and I don't think they should be villainized, who are beginning to reject Monsanto seed, and they are seriously considering the 3-year transition effort that is required to go organic. You know, the problem is, how do you go for those 3 years without using GMOs before you can certify organic? But we've got a booming consultancy industry now that's growing to help these farmers transition off of the Monsanto genetically modified seed.
Oh, I was just going to say that I just saw recently the results of the 30-year farming systems trials they did at Rodale in Pennsylvania, which started out just organic versus conventional, and the organic did better through those years. In the last, I don't know, 5 or so years, they've been using GMOs there, and it didn't change. I mean, the organic very much outshines in terms of profitability and productivity the genetically modified corn. So there's no really good reason to use it except to allow Monsanto to sell more Roundup.
One of the most salacious things Monsanto argues is, well, there isn't any evidence that genetically modified seed is harmful. And they say that and they put a period. Well, what they don't tell you is that their patents allow them to prevent anyone from doing any research, because we do not have a research exemption here in the United States like they do in Europe. So there have been people who have wanted to do independent, unbiased, third party, they weren't organic, they just wanted independent, unbiased research, and they couldn't because Monsanto wouldn't let them. Or Monsanto would say, well, you can do it, but you have to give us the results first, and we can prohibit you from publishing them or speaking about them. And we know that scientists, renowned scientists from throughout the world, who have ever been critical or ever raised any questions about Monsanto's genetically modified seed, have been politically destroyed. They've had their reputations attacked and discredited. So when Monsanto says there's not sufficient evidence here to draw a conclusion, what people need to realize is the only party to blame for the lack of evidence is Monsanto. If their stuff is so good, they should allow anyone to do independent research. Allow Consumer Reports, Consumers Union, any other verified, responsible, reputable third party. Just test their claims. And if we're wrong and they're right, then they'll be validated. But they don't let that happen, and that in itself proves how insecure at best they are about their technology, or how devastatingly bad they know the truth is, and that's why they're trying to conceal it.
And the news has been coming out this year specifically very bad about the super weeds. There's insect resistance to some of the BT insect resistant corn. And then there's questions about soil organisms in these soils that are drenched with Roundup, and also some very serious questions about animal health with all this Roundup. And I guess the allowances for Roundup residues on many of these crops have gone up enormously, as they found they have to keep putting on the Roundup herbicide to make it work, which anyone who paid attention to the way nature works would know it's what's going to happen. It's the weeds are going to become resistant.
And let me just respond to another argument Monsanto makes, which is, well, our plaintiffs and our interests are just anti-science. We're just against science. We're against genetics. We just want to refuse all this kind of stuff. Nothing could be farther from the truth. You know, there are natural breeding technologies that work great, and many of our clients do them. They've dedicated their life to them. But there are just some species that just are not going to combine together. And that's natural selection. That's the way God wants it to happen. So science has to respect the earth and vice versa. And so to say that we're just Luddites who just want to put our head in the sand and not be pragmatic just ignores both who we are and also, as Bill pointed out, at the end of the day, organic products are better, cheaper, faster than Monsanto's products. All Monsanto has really is a better marketing team, a better sales team. They can come up with better gimmicks, and they can pay people to drive around and threaten the farmers who they want to threaten and make false promises to those who are susceptible to false promises. But that's the only advantage Monsanto has, is their PR machine.
Another aspect of this whole thing, which is coming up, is the labeling of the products in the marketplace. You go into the supermarket and 70-80% of the food in there contains genetically modified ingredients, or the meat all eaten genetically modified grains. But we don't know which is which. And we're Connecticut NOFA is involved with an initiative of legislators in Connecticut who are going to put forth a labeling bill for Connecticut. There's also a labeling bill in Congress. And there was a march from New York to Washington to encourage more labeling.
Yeah, Monsanto is one of the only big companies I know of that doesn't like to brag about its product being in what you buy. You know, we've all bought computers that had the little sticker Intel inside, right? We'd have no idea Intel processors were in there if it wasn't for the little sticker. Well, why doesn't Monsanto have its little stickers on all the food in the grocery store saying Monsanto genetically modified seed inside? You know why? Because they know 90% of consumers would reject it. Because 90% of consumers have common sense. And even if they aren't absolutely convinced yet by the science, they will be. There's an intuition that says this is something that should at least be studied further, if not absolutely rejected, which is what rest of the world has basically decided. So they don't want truth in advertising. You know, it's pretty funny. When they go to the labeling authorities, you know, the FDA, they say, well, we don't need to be labeled because we're no different than regular food. We're the same as regular food. Then down the street, they go to the patent office and say, give us patents because we're completely different than regular food. We're so new and inventive, we deserve dozens and dozens of patents. So they talk out of one side of their mouth when they're talking to one group of regulators, and they talk out of the other side of their mouth when they're talking to another group of regulators. And it just proves that they really don't have anything to be proud of here.
Dan, they've charged you as a Luddite, but your background from undergrad is as a Bachelor of Science in... is it material science? Can you talk about what drew you from that to the law and how you might have gone from law school to deciding Public Patent Foundation was the place to be doing good work?
Yeah, well, when I was in engineering school, I loved it. But I also really liked politics and social policy. So I actually studied political science in undergrad as well, and then went to law school. And I loved the intersection of technology and the law, which is what took me to do patent law, but also software licensing, other related areas of the law. But I was always concerned that the public, who's supposed to benefit from the patent system, wasn't getting a fair shake because it wasn't being adequately represented. You know, patent holders get adequately represented. Patent attorneys get adequately represented. Large companies, they get adequately represented in the system. But the public doesn't even know that the patent system impacts them. And so, much like the environmental movement 30, 40 years ago, when people didn't realize how a company polluting the rivers could actually have a negative impact on them, I think that's where we are now with these type of patent, copyright, other intellectual property laws. So the mission of the organization is to ensure that the public interest is just represented in the patent system. The public interest is not treated fairly when we have patents that are undeserved or where we have patent owners who are allowed to use their patents aggressively. If we read the Constitution, the purpose of the patent system is to promote progress. Progress has both an incentivizing aspect and also an access aspect. And what I mean by that is the patent system would not work well if we had patents that last 10 million years. That would create a lot of incentive for people to invest and innovate, but it would create no access. And that wouldn't be a system that we want. We want a balanced system that's halfway between incentives and access. So we have to make sure that patent owners who always want to deny access so they can derive rents from the marketplace don't always get their way. And so the organization, we've done many cases that I feel very passionate about. We've done cases involving stem cells, patents on human genes, internet technologies. In this case, I actually got started with after a farmer came up to me after a talk that I was giving on the case we have involving breast cancer. And he said, well, have you heard about Monsanto and what their patents are doing? I said, well, tell me more about that. And that's what started this.
In deciding to take the case, you mentioned being persuaded to take it among other options that the Public Patent Foundation could have pursued. Mm-hmm. Were there particular mentors or thought leaders from outside the plaintiff class who encouraged you to take it or influenced your thinking?
There's lots of people who influence our work. Principally, there are lots of other attorneys who are dealing with access issues. Not many of them deal with patent issues specifically. And so that's why there was a niche opportunity for a patent attorney to do public service. And then we started the organization. So all the people before us, you know, we're modeled at Cardozo Law School off of the, in some ways, the Innocence Project, which is about ensuring that people who don't have adequate representation are given a fair day in court, especially before one of the severest sanctions possible, or the severest sanction possible, is imposed. And so, undertaking good public work in a transparent way and calling into question acts by our government and corporate entities that may not be serving the American people in the best way possible, I think is a legitimate use of our resources.
Bill, you're a farmer. You have an opportunity to go up to Dan and suggest cases he might want to take on. Are there other fields in agriculture or food that you think would benefit from an adversarial or transactional legal approach?
I think this is the big one, and all the many issues around this. Most of the other issues we come around in Connecticut have to do with sort of food safety things, and which aren't really, I don't see now, fit in with this model at all. There may be some things in the future. A lot of it, I mean, the other thing is, like raw milk, which many states want to make illegal, and many people would like to drink, and many farmers would like to grow. And Connecticut, we're very blessed with good raw milk regulations, which make it accessible to the public, but other places it's not. And sort of freedom to choose what you're going to eat and to eat what you want, which is sort of connected with this in a way of freedom to know what you're eating.
Yeah, we did a survey of all the other agricultural organizations, and none of them were as aggressive and obnoxious as Monsanto. I don't know of any other agricultural company that has actually sued small independent farmers and rendered them bankrupt. I just don't know of anyone who's done that. Only Monsanto has been so aggressive. On our website, there's a video from the CBS Evening News when they did a story about people who had been contaminated and then threatened by Monsanto with patent infringement, exactly what I was talking about earlier. And at one point, the interviewer raises this letter that had been written by Monsanto to the family saying, well, the Iowa, I believe it was, Department of such and such gave us permission to come on your property. Well, that letter was written several weeks before that department even existed. And when confronted with this, the Monsanto representative didn't really have a response, because there isn't a response. The response is, we're an obnoxious company. We think we have the right to do whatever we want, whenever we want, without any regard to anyone else. It sounds a lot like the banks or BP or the tobacco companies and all these other corporations who the law and econ people like us think, well, whatever makes corporate wealth is good for society. But those of us with a little better insight on reality, no, is not always the truth. That corporations have an incentive to maximize their profit, the public be damned. And so they need to be held in check with sufficient checks and balances. And public service, public interest litigation, public interest transaction work is necessary to provide one of the checks and balances to make sure that corporations aren't allowed to abuse the public.
This is the big suit against the big public enemy. So tell us, do you think you're going to win?
I don't take cases unless I know I'm going to win. I don't like to lose. I was shocked that they hired a former Solicitor General of the United States to, as I would say, slum it down in district court, because he generally just has an appellate practice. But I look forward to advocating against him in court. But in this case, the facts are just going to speak for themselves. Any idiot could do it. And these are just so clear. I just don't have any concern about it. We're waiting now. They filed this motion to dismiss, this multiple dozen page motion to dismiss with hundreds of pages of attachments and exhibits and documents and this, that, the other. It was a binder so big I had to carry it in two loads rather than write us a one page letter saying they'd never sue our clients. So the judge is now trying to weed through all that, and she'll decide whether or not she believes this case has enough, is real enough to merit the court's attention. So we're faithful. We'll survive the motion to dismiss, and then we'll move on to this discovery stage of the case and eventually receive a favorable substantive ruling.
Tremendous.
There's another thing of opportunity missed. We used to have a great extension system in this country, which worked for farmers. A lot of public plant breeding, which happened at land-grant universities to breed seeds specifically for farmers in that state or in that zone. And with the coming in of biotechnology and the sort of belief in that at the higher levels of agriculture, all that public seed breeding has disappeared. So we've lost, 20, 30 years of what might be doing successful seeds and going down this wrong path of genetically modified seeds.
Bill, Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.